You're listening to The Robin and Boom Show, engaging the contemporary world with the great tradition. Find us on our YouTube channel, our Facebook page, or on our website at robinmarkphillips.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. Now, here's today's co-host, Robin Phillips.
Welcome to The Robin and Boom Show. I'm a little bit excited because this is our seventh episode since we launched. And I don't know about you, Jason, but it's hard for me to believe how much ground we've been able to cover so far, just in the six shows that we've done so far. From we've talked about politics to technology to classical education to emotional wellness. And we don't just choose topics haphazardly. We carefully pick our topics based on the common theme of the flourishing of the soul. We want this podcast to give you the resource for understanding what it means for the soul to flourish in the contemporary world with all the challenges that we face. And we use resources from classical antiquity and Christianity to shed light on the important question of what soul flourishing looks like today. If you've just discovered us, please check out our archives. I would particularly draw your attention to episode number 5, where we interviewed a social worker from Spokane, Washington, who has recently discovered that classical education helps buffer students from the effects of anxiety, depression, and addiction. And we had a very fascinating discussion with this social worker about the liberal arts and the role that they play in mental and emotional wellness. So to find our archives, just put in the Robin and Boom Show into any podcast service. But when you type it out, don't spell out and, A-N-D. Use the little character for and. I don't even know what you call that character, but on my keyboard, it shares a space with the number 7. So the Robin and Boom Show with and, with this character, and it will pop up. We're on iTunes, on Spotify, Stitcher, CastBox. All of these different podcast apps are hosting us, so we're really excited about that. We're really excited about the visibility that we're getting all over both iPhones and Android devices. We also have a Facebook page that you can connect. You can connect with our fan community through that. You can post questions for Jason and me to answer on the show. We have a YouTube channel, so you can subscribe to us. So there's a lot happening, and we're really excited. But Jason and I are especially excited today because we are joined for the second week in a row with Dr. David Wang. Dr. David Wang, as I mentioned in the last week's podcast, he has spent his academic career studying buildings, architectural theory, and more recently, he's been studying the theology of sacraments and how sacramentality relates to buildings. So last week in our discussion, Jason and I talked to Dr. Wang about the tragedy at Notre Dame, and he was helping us to process some of what we're feeling as individuals and collectively as a society as we come to terms with this loss. I know it was very troubling for me. I was at work when I heard the news about this on National Public Radio. I was listening to National Public Radio and I started to cry, literally right there at work as I heard the news. And that experience has been quite common across really all of the entire Western world and other parts of the world as well. So last week, Dr. Wang talked about some of the deeper attachment needs that we feel as human beings and the important role that materiality plays in anchoring us to place and to community and to each other. And we talked about how even in our modern culture, in which the ethic of the machine gives us a very disembodied way of looking at the world and ourselves, there is still a continued need for sacramentality, for embodiment, for the interconnection of the spiritual and the material. And this gives us a point of contact with Gothic cathedrals, even if we don't understand what's going on. So cathedrals such as Notre Dame, they testify to the infusion of God into the cosmos. And even more particularly, the way the church connects heaven and earth sacramentally. So Dr. Wang, could you tell us more about sacramentality and how that relates to buildings?
Yes. Well, again, thanks once again for having me. I think from last week, I think it would be helpful for me to reiterate the definition of sacramentality that I use in my book. It is it's a participatory formulation where the small human being is in the embrace of an immensely large immaterial reality, such that the small human being receives benefit. Here's an example, in fact, where this notion of sacrament comes from. It was used, a sacramentum was sort of the rite or the oath that a Roman soldier took upon joining the Roman military. And he entered into a sacramentum. And out of that, he reaped the benefits of participation in this very large sort of Pax Romana, of which the Roman military, of course, was the sort of the one material instantiation of this widespread Roman reality. So the early Christians took this notion of sacramentum, and Tertullian, for instance, spoke of martyrdom as a sacramentum, that we small human being enter into martyrdom for the Christian faith as a sacramentum. And and by the time of Augustine, certainly baptism and the Lord's Supper and the Eucharist, that is, were well established as sacraments, in the sense that a small human being enters into a large immaterial reality for the benefit of that human being. So what we can say is that if you abstract sacrament from its moorings and specific church liturgies, what we can say is that human beings are built for sacramentum. Last week, I gave an example of, like, because the fact that I've lived in my house for 10 years, I have participated in a world where of which this physical structure is an expression of those of all of those experiences. And if my house burnt down, hopefully I have enough insurance and I can scrape up some money to rebuild something. But what I have lost is the marks of those experiences that I participated in. I've lost the sort of the sacramental aspect of the history of it. Now, 20 years later, the new structure will also give me, take on meanings of participation. And part of those meanings, if I'm still around, is the memory of how this is a replacement of the previous one. My point is that in architecture now, and this is getting to our point, up until the postmodern era, architecture has always served to be a physical marker, a physical instantiation of small human being participating in a large reality for his or her benefit. That is true in pre-Christian times. That's true in Christian times. And if you look at other cultures, that's true in other cultures. So it's a universal human reality that buildings, in particular, and material culture in general, these objects of material culture are meaningful to us because they are the sort of the material expression of me as a small human being participating in a vastly extended immaterial reality for my good. And of course, in Christian confession, that vast immaterial reality is God. I mean, it's so, but it could be the Roman military. It could be the National Football League. It could be, why do you think the football teams make millions of dollars, not only in ticket sales, but all of the paraphernalia, you know, the Seattle Seahawks cap, the jerseys with the players' names on the back, all of that, you know, the towels, the, you know, the license plates with the Seattle Seahawks emblem on it. I mean, all of that is a small human being participating in a vast reality of sportsdom and Seattle Seahawks by this little object that I have. I have this, and I don't, but I mean, I'm speaking rhetorically. I have this license plate with a Seattle Seahawk emblem on it. So the materiality is always a material sign of my participation in a vastly extended reality that's for my benefit in some way or another. And to that extent, I'm participating in sacramentum. So if you would bear with me, I'll just foam at the mouth a little longer. I mentioned postmodernism rejects this view, and postmodern architecture, the theory behind that, rejects this view. And we could just look at one of the major theorist architects of postmodernism, which is Robert Venturi. Robert Venturi in the 60s and 70s coined the term that architecture is no more than decorated sheds. So since the beginning of postmodernism, what we architects do is we take a box and we decorate it. We decorate it to look like a casino. We decorate it to look like a hotel. We decorate it to look like a church. We decorate it to look like a house. It doesn't matter what you're decorating it for. You just take a box and decorate it. This is the postmodern gospel, as it were, when it comes to architecture, and it is pervasive in the way that architecture was taught, I would say, up until electronic cyber sort of computer came in, and that's another conversation. But if you take that, a book like Robert Venturi's Learning from Las Vegas, where he propounds this, he calls Chartres Cathedral, a decorated box. And so if Chartres Cathedral is a decorated box, then what we now have is a rejection of history and embodiment. So at any rate, that brings us back to Notre Dame. So Notre Dame. So I'll stop talking at this point.
Yeah. Wow. That's interesting. So it sounds to me like you're saying that even though there's this rejection of embodiment, because human beings still have this need to participate in a vast extended immaterial reality, that this finds expression maybe not in buildings anymore, but in things like sports, where we can belong to something bigger than ourselves. And the reason that so many people worked for over a century to build the Cathedral of Notre Dame and to put in labor that they knew would not they would not live to see complete, even that their grandchildren wouldn't live to see complete. They were propelled and animated by this sense that they were part of something bigger, part of a vast extended immaterial reality that in that case connected heaven and earth sacramentally in a very visible way.
Yes, that's true. They were participating in something at least transgenerational. I mean, and that just that practice alone tells us how vast this communion was, and how the actions of, you know, never mind the liturgies that go on in built churches. I mean, the very fact of cutting stone becomes a liturgy because becomes a sacramental practice, because here I am, I'm cutting stone, I'm building the house of God, you know, and it's not about getting it done in on time and on budget, you know, as we architects say. I mean, it's not about that. It's not about schedules. It's not about what I'm going to do when I retire. I mean, this is my life. You know, this is how I participate in God. Hey, look, I mean, what did the royalty do during these centuries? They got themselves buried inside the cathedrals. So what more do we need to try to comprehend this type of mentality when, you know, I am secure. I'm secure when I die, because I am buried in heaven. I'm buried in this structure, which I take to be the representation. I'm not representation, but the presence of heaven on earth. And therefore, when I die, I'm secure because I'm buried in it. I mean, we Protestants would say, yeah, what about Jesus Christ? What about, you know, your justification, sanctification in Jesus Christ? Well, that's a conversation, but that's actually not how they viewed it. They viewed the material object as the ship, if you will, that carries them into heaven. And we need to respect that, even though I think subsequent Protestantism would say you got your theology wrong. We need to respect that view in the sense of its impact on the value it had, these people gave to material culture, specifically the cathedral, but all sorts of other materiality that they had during the medieval period, the dress, the sort of the emblems, all of that it was not sort of wear disposable clothing, but they were emblems of belonging. And to that extent, they lived in a sacramental world.
Yeah, how different that is from today. Not only is everything disposable, but there's this striving almost for disembodiment, if you will. I mean, you this is something you mentioned earlier. I can't remember if it was this week or last week, but how the culture of the machine has oriented us towards a disembodied ethic. And it's interesting because a lot of the Silicon Valley theorists, the way they're talking about technology now, and really for the last 15 years, they talk about the physical body as a kind of fall that our machines will liberate us from. And you can read this in Nicholas Carr's book, The Big Switch, and I think he also has a couple essays about it in his book of Utopia is Creepy. But just seeing what people are saying about how the machine will liberate us from the limitations and the constraints that come with being substantiated in a material body. So there's this there's this striving for a disembodied anthropology. And is that, do we see that expressed even, shall I say, sacramentally within postmodern architecture?
Do we see what? I'm sorry.
This ethic of disembodiment, do we see that expressed in postmodern architecture?
So I'm going to suggest three stages. One is up until postmodernism, we have what we've been talking about, buildings being material expressions of sacramental participation on the part of small human being in something huge, something large. That was true in antiquity all the way up to 20th century postmodernism. So we're talking 20 centuries at least. So that's one snapshot, if you will. Postmodernism, on the strength of Venturi's theories, speaks about the buildings as decorated boxes. So that's postmodernism. We are now in something even more serious, where, as you said, Robin, we have a few billionaires talking about uploading their brains to cyberspace so that they can have eternal life. I mean, this is something new, and how it's going to impact architecture, I think we can see harbingers of it, but I'm not sure. You know, we haven't entered into fully what this type of cyber reality can mean. I mean, the very fact that we are having this conversation via electronic format that spans the globe, there are many things attractive about this. But we're not in one room. I'm not looking at you. I'm not, you know, you're not sort of, as Clifford Geertz famously said, I couldn't wink at you. I mean, what does that wink mean? You know, when you're disembodied, we don't know. We don't know what this third stage will bring, because we're in it. But you're absolutely right. It's very concerning that we have people now talking about uploading their brains. You know, that is a total erasure of materiality. But then, ironically, it's the billionaires that have the money to sort of do this and have the time to muse about this. Many of them are giving a lot of money to restore Notre Dame. So what can I say?
So I wonder, Jason, I'm just thinking, as Dr. Wang is talking, if virtuality is in some sense the opposite of sacramentality. What are your thoughts, Jason?
Yes and no. Because with sacramentality, what's going on is a complete engagement of the whole human person. In virtuality, relates actually to an element in sacramentality, because with virtuality, there is representation of something that we're engaging in. So actually, in the whole sacramental process, there's an external thing that's going on, but then there's our internal representation. So David, I think it was in a previous episode, was talking about the building outside rhyming with what's inside us. So there's a modern virtuality is a technological development, a kind of exteriorization of this internal representation that goes along with sacramentality. What's the problem is that the whole connection, like David's been talking about sacramentality as this overarching big presence that connects these two things, has been jettisoned. That's really what's been destroyed. So it's a virtuality that's untethered from the whole body engagement. That's really the problem here.
Yes. And it's not just billionaires who want to upload their brains. It's affected it's affected all of us, how we interact, how we think of community, how we think of relationships. As community and relationships and communication are mediated through machines, it does, in some sense, alter how we think of these things, but perhaps in ways that we're not fully aware of.
Yep.
Interesting.
Maybe we should say we live in a brave new cyber world.
I doubt it's going to last that long. This something that is that disconnected from how human beings act is simply not sustainable. I'm not saying something's going to happen, but I think it's just things are going to get a lot more simpler and primitive, maybe in a bad way, but maybe a new dark ages. Maybe the cyber world will become a new dark ages.
If you look at the, at least as I look at the 20th century, at the beginning of the 20th century, all of Europe, all of the European intellectual elite thought that utopia had arrived. I mean, the machine was going to solve all of our problems. It's going to elevate quality of life for everyone. We've arrived. And if you read some of the architectural theoretical literature, Le Corbusier's Towards a New Architecture, for example, it was a celebration of the fact that utopia is just right around the corner. Then, as we all know, in 1914, the First World War started, and I believe that took 15 million lives. A couple of decades later, Second World War started and took 60 million lives. That's not counting the aftermath under Stalin and Mao. The machine, those kinds of staggering numbers would have been impossible without the machine. So my point is that the advent of the machine age, or at least the arrival of the machine in the 20th century, made the 20th century, the deaths brought on by war in the 20th century outnumbers all deaths by war of the previous centuries combined. This was the result of a technological innovation. Now we have cyber connectivity. This is not exactly a machine technology because, you know, I may be in front of a little box called a computer. The physicality of the box may be the machine, but this is no machine. I mean, this is something that erases distance. You know, if you think about the locomotive as erasing distance. You know, I mean, you can travel, you know, 100 miles a day, you know. I'm talking to you, Jason, across the world. And how this technology will impact human life, how it would be harnessed to harm people, I don't want to be pessimistic. But just as the machine taught us new ways of embodiment, the computer's technology will also shape how we have new views of embodiment. And the jury's still out. I mean, it's, the jury's still out.
Yeah, it's interesting. As we erase distance and as our friendships and our communities and our connections are no longer tethered to the geographical space in which we physically live, it seems to give a new freedom to relationships because we can customize our relationships based on our needs, our views, and our likes and dislikes rather than having to do with the person next door, the people in my little village. I may not like the milkman and the butcher, but they're part of my village, so I better learn to get along with them. Whereas now it's very different. We typically have one community for church, another community for work, maybe another community for our children's school, another for our neighborhood. If we have any community in our neighborhood at all, because, you know, you can, with garage doors now, you can open them by remote drive in, shut them behind you, and go into your house without ever having to actually be physically present in your neighborhood. And so we have all these multiple communities, but the people that we know in these communities don't know each other because these communities are disengaged from physical space. And that makes them very unnatural. It gives these the disengagement from embodiment, from physical spatial geography, gives these communities a very provisional and contingent quality or disposable, to pick up on your earlier theme, because they're disposable, because when the going gets rough, we can just switch to a different community. We can go to a different church, different school, or move to a different town. This transient nature of our communal life, I think, leaves our basic attachment needs very unfulfilled. And this is behind widespread loneliness. It's one of the, not the only reason. And so I think social media, when our relationships are mediated through machines, this is very emblematic of a disembodied, customized community. But even in the real world, we see this type of disembodiment when our communities lose an organic connection with the land, with embodiment and physical space. I don't know if that makes any sense at all.
I think it does. And to add to your point, by going back to Jason's point about the possibility that cyber connectivity and the life that it generates may not be sustainable. Well, I think this toggles us back full circle to Notre Dame. I mean, the grief that people experience over the loss of it might be one indication of just how rooted we are to embodiment. And it's a way in to conversations about sacramentality, conversations about participation, far beyond sort of physical participation, meaning, you know, let's all go to Paris and go to Notre Dame. It's a worldwide participation. I have a Muslim friend who put on Facebook how grieved he is about the loss of this structure. So we touch on something universal here with the loss of a physical structure like Notre Dame, in the sense that we all have this sort of this notion that something has been lost here, that even rebuilding will not totally replace. And to the extent that we have that type of grief, that affirms the fact that there's something screwball about living disembodied lives, and hopefully that type of thing won't be sustainable. But this is the reality we're living in. I mean, talk to any 19-year-old, 18-year-old. I mean, they're totally immersed in. I remember, you know, I go to my kids who are now in their 30s with questions about, you know, cyber things that they're very dexterous with. They are totally, they don't hold a candle to people that are 15 years younger than them. I mean, so we're living it. So we're gonna, the world will be led by people who are not like us. I mean, they are people of cyber connectivity, and we will see how that goes.
Thank you for listening to today's broadcast. The Robin and Boom Show is made possible through the generous support of listeners like you. To become a patron of the show, go to robinmarkphillips.com and select the Robin Boom Show from the drop-down menu. If you have questions you'd like to have addressed on a future episode, send us a message through our Facebook page. Once again, thanks for listening.